Welcome everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Jason, WF2N, will be your co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. We also offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange-colored type. But if you would like a simple URL to find it, and you might want to take a look at it because it's an illustration, so it's going to be difficult to explain it over the radio. So you can find it by just typing into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser at stream.kc2rc.com. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try my best to provide a cogent answer, and Jason, WF2N, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment and, when recognized, offer their knowledge and experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Jason, WF2N. Good evening, Jason. Oh, well, perhaps Jason is running a little late tonight. Hopefully he'll get on a little bit later. Please, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So if you have any questions of a technical nature, please feel free, check in, give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, Mo recognized. My neighbor Joe recognized. I assume you're mobile because the signal isn't that strong for a change. So I hope you're taking a nice ride. So Joe and Mo recognized. Is there anyone else out there who has either a comment or a technical question for tonight's TechNet? Okay, maybe people are running late. Mo, into... It's N2YU, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. This is Mo in San Al. I'm on an HD, but I'm using a roof antenna with 5 watts. So I hope you're copying me okay. I don't have any traffic for the net, just supporting. And good to hear you on, Roy. Back to net from N2YU.
Okay, very good, Mo. Yeah, I've kind of heard you on the repeaters around. Congratulations on graduating with your master's degree. I attended New York University as well, so I kind of recognize the call sign. We have another a member of our club, KG2C, who, when he graduated from NYU, took a call sign that reflected that, and then he changed to a different one later on. So I'm glad that you're checking us out. I saw that you were looking around, I guess, in the digital stream, using the Fusion side of this repeater.
I'm pretty new with Fusion. Thank you so much for your kind words, Roy. Very interesting about KG2C and about both of you being alums. That's really great. And it would be nice to start the club back up again. But yeah, pretty new to Fusion, so just programmed this FT70ZR. But I really appreciate all your kind words. Back to net. This is N2YU.
Okay, very good, Mo. Once again, I am AC2GS. This is hopefully the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here every second and fourth Wednesday of the month. We take questions, we take topics. You know, ultimately, any topic other than politics and religion, because we really don't want to deal with that, is acceptable, but we prefer questions of a technical nature to amateur radio. If anyone has any questions tonight, please feel free to present them here. You know, any topics or questions. Just give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, looks like it's going to be one of those nights. Well, what can I tell you? Thankfully, on Sunday nights, so when I'm doing the Limark Technical Net, things are a wee bit livelier. We just got to find some way of getting people to stick to their radio seats during Wednesday nights, at least the second and fourth Wednesday night. And that's another point that you might want to scribble down, Mo, if you're interested in nets and technical nets. We have the metropolitan area has another technical net on Sunday nights at 8 o'clock that you might be interested in listening to as well. Anyway, this is AC2GS, and this is supposed to be the biweekly Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So I will once again ask if anyone has any questions of a technical nature or topics they would like to discuss. If so, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give us your first name and your call sign.
KD2NBP, this is Bob. I was holding off, but I have a couple kind of COVID questions. I was trying to hold off, hoping there'd be some radio questions, but since nobody's coming in, maybe I could throw some of those at you. I just listened to a show that brings up some questions. Anyway, back to you.
Yeah, sure, Bob. We can handle your questions, and when they're done, I'll ask if anyone has technical stuff. So, you know, we can put as many questions in as anyone has time for. So what's your questions tonight, Bob?
First one is, a couple weeks ago I had some little bug of something, and of course I got all scared that it was COVID, and I don't know because I never got tested at the time. I thought about it, but I was worried about exposure risk. And so now, at some point, I might want to get an antibody test. I'm wondering if you had any opinion or latest information on how reliable are those things, both the sensitivity and specificity, meaning, you know what it means, whether false positives versus false negatives, and do you know anything about that? And then I have some other questions just because of a show I heard on the radio, and the guy brought up some interesting stuff. So first, that question.
Well, the problem, Bob, is that they're not all the same tests. Unfortunately, there was this free-for-all where the Food and Drug Administration kind of approved a lot of different antibody tests of dubious quality. They range all over the place. There are some antibody tests that I've read some research reports that suggest about 95% of the time they're accurate, but I've heard of other antibody tests that have scored as little as 40% accurate. So yeah, there's there's false positives, there's false negatives. You don't want either of those. In a perfect universe, you want something that's 100% with no errors, but almost nothing exists that's perfect. But 5% error is usually acceptable. 40% is awful. So it sort of depends upon which of the many types of antibody tests the testing facility that you go to is using. I wouldn't take it as a fait accompli, the results, again, because of the variableness of it. It's better than having no tests, but it's not a get-out-of-jail-for-free card, because it could be false positive that you were exposed in the past when, in fact, you weren't. And then if you just run around and lick the subway rails, you'll get sick. So I hope that helps. I know it doesn't ultimately answer the question precisely.
Thanks, Roy. You probably don't know off the top of your head which are the good tests and which are the bad ones. I guess knowing that, I'll just have to do some internet searching. And, of course, I also am aware of the fact that it is not proven that anybody's mean you have immunity. It seems probable, but it's not proven. So I'm well aware of that as well. And also, I still worry about, going in there and standing next to someone while they take the test. My understanding is I think they only have to prick your finger and get a small amount of blood. But maybe that varies from test to test as well.
As far as I'm aware, that they need a vial of blood. So I don't think this is a finger prick. Finger pricks are great for if they're checking your sugar for diabetes. But with something like this, my guess would be that they would fill up a portion of a tube for the antibody test.
Okay, so they're going to draw blood, just like a typical blood test. I just listened to the show by, you probably know this show, Dr. Michio Kaku, who's a physicist who does this show called Exploration, and he was talking about different things like vaccines for COVID. And I don't know the date of this program when it was first made. He was talking about that London study, which I think you said now doesn't look as optimistic as it did at first with results. And he was saying it looked promising, so it might be an older show. But he also mentioned some interesting stuff. A bunch of stuff I can't remember at all, but there was one thing I was going to say, and now it's slipping my mind. Just give me a second. The people, there are actually people volunteering for these different studies for vaccines, volunteering to like take the vaccine and get themselves, quote unquote, infected to see if it works. So what if you know anything about that one? Back to you.
Well, when scientists say something is promising, that's basically cursing with very light praise. It's sort of the response that a polite person answers when their wife asks them if something they're wearing makes them look too fat. So you have to kind of decode in from sciences. When they say it's promising, it pretty much means that, well, at least it hasn't killed everyone, so we might get something out of it. So when they tell people that things are promising, don't go running for the champagne bottles to celebrate, unfortunately. Most promising things never fulfill their promise. The problem with the Oxford vaccine is, they initially said that, people who were vaccinated didn't come down with the virus. They actually did. They were still infectious. There was some suggestion that the amount of the infection was less, but it was on a very small sample size, but it didn't stop you from getting infected with COVID-19. And although it did produce some antibodies, the amount of antibodies it produced was barely the minimum that the test could pick up. When they diluted it 50%, the sensitivity of the antibody test couldn't even pick them up. So it doesn't look terribly good. It might pan out ultimately, but right now I wouldn't celebrate. But there's 100 other vaccines out there that are being tested, and the trick is we both have to find something that is safe, that won't have a side effect. You'll remember swine flu, there was a little nasty tendency for people developing a neurological disorder called Guillain-Barré. Some people died of that. So you don't want to be make people sicker by taking the vaccine, and you also want it to produce a significant enough immune response so that hopefully you won't come down with the virus at all, rather than, you know, it won't be quite as awful as it would otherwise be. But, you know, work is continuing. I may have not answered that completely, but if you want to ask the part of the question I didn't get to, please feel free.
No, Roy, I get the idea. And I'm aware, yeah, when they say a prophecy, I mean, of course, nobody knows. It's hard to, as they say, it's hard to predict, especially when it's the future. Heard somebody say that. Anyway, yeah, he had all these other things, too. He seemed pretty doing an optimistic kind of take on things. Some about some technology they could, I can't really get this right, but you may have heard of this. If I even explain it badly, you might know what I'm saying. Some way of detecting hot spots. It must be a satellite or what, like almost like where people, congregations of people with fevers are, so they could point out hot spots earlier to prevent something like what happened during Mardi Gras in New Orleans. This was his example. Anyway, I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, because I'm not saying this too well, because I was washing dishes and listening to this program just before this. All right, back to you, Roy.
AC2GS. I would kind of doubt, I mean, you never know with spy satellites, but I doubt that we've gotten to the point where we have the resolution to pinpoint infrared signals of everyone and be able to discern the difference between 98.6 and, say, 101 or 102. It's much more likely that people who buy these little thermometer things that can be tagged onto your cell phone via Bluetooth, and then they upload the data to a central server, and they've been mapping atypical fever breakouts all over the country in the last 2-3 months. They noticed that southern Florida was kind of picking up with atypical fevers after the influenza season had pretty much died down. So there are other ways of doing it. It's not quite the direct method, somewhat indirect. But, you know, unless the spy satellites are much, much better than I give them credit to be, I don't think they could actually check the temperature of people passing underhead.
Yeah, I think it was satellites. I can't think of anything else it would be. And it was, I don't think it's so specific, but just like areas where a lot of people had a higher temperature, and they wouldn't, I don't think it was so specific what they would know exact temperatures, but I don't know. It seemed like it was just like if there were a lot of people that had fevers in a certain area, they could detect that. That's what I got out of it. Anyway, back to you.
Okay. I mean, if we end up having a stadium full of febrile people, I think we pretty much in tough luck, because that's Mardi Gras season all over again. So maybe he was alluding to that. I don't think there's going to be an opportunity too soon for a kind of test of something similar to Mardi Gras, where there's thousands of people in very high proximity to each other outside. So maybe he was alluding to things like that.
Roy, yeah, I won't go on about this because, you know, maybe I'll email you a link if I find a, he probably has archives of these shows. If you care to listen to it, it's up to you. It's about a half an hour. Dr. Michio Kaku, physicist, and, you know, he's Pivani. Anyway, the first half of this show he does is like half an hour. And you can choose whether or not to listen to it if I find the link and email it to you. So I'll go back to Ned. I hope some people have some questions. Maybe I'll try to think of a radio question. So back to Ned.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Bob. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. I am net control operator for the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. The Technical Net is something that we do every second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 9 p.m. here, and we're trying to do it here. So if anyone has any questions of a technical nature or any technical topics they would like to discuss or have discussed, just hit that push-to-talk button, give us your first name and your call sign.
WF2N, Roy, you're reading me?
Yes, Jason, welcome aboard. Yeah, we hear you.
Okay, Roy, thanks so much, and apologies. I was having some difficulty, but I think I figured it out. Internal run of coax, I think, is damaged. I swapped it out with the coax I run for my HF rig inside, and everything seems to be working now. So I am here. Back to you.
Okay, very good, Jason. Yeah, well, you never know with coax. I mean, I buy, you know, relatively good quality LMR-400, but, you know, mechanical things can cause malfunctions, and you never quite know. So glad to have you back. So this is AC2GS, Roy here, and my co-host, Jason, WF2N. And we're sitting around waiting for a technical question. If anyone has any questions of a technical nature or topics they would like to discuss tonight, please hit that push-to-talk button and give us your first name and your call sign. Okie doke, going to be one of those nights. Let's take it over to the TechNet puzzle question. And once again, you can find the TechNet puzzle by going to the front page of our club website, www.kc2rc.com, or www.kingscountyradioclub.com. And in the middle, in orange colored type, there's a link to our puzzle page. If you don't want to go through that way, you could just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com, and it'll bring you to our puzzle page because there is an illustration. Well, what it amounts to is there is a voltage time graph that gives the voltage across the smoothing capacitor in a half-wave rectifier power circuit. The question is that the current running through the diode rectifier portion of that half-wave rectifying power supply is depicted in one of four different graphs, A, B, C, or D. So the question is, if anyone would like to play, which of the four graphs to the right are the current that's going through the half-wave rectifier as part of the power supply? Anyone want to play along?
E2NVP, I have a guess, which is a hunch, which may be totally wrong. So if no one else knows any more about this, I can picture my guess.
Okay, Bob, please give us your guess.
I'm going to say C.
Okay, you see, the problem, though, is C is the current that might have gone through the half-wave rectifier if instead of a smoothing capacitor, you replace it with just a regular resistance load. So if you, because, you know, there's the voltage potential and then there's the current, and that's related to resistance and impedance and such. So whereas the voltage potential of the half-wave rectifier would be graph C, you have to think in terms of the current, and the current isn't necessarily the same as the voltage.
Then how about B?
Okay. B wouldn't quite be it, because B would be probably closer to the current being drawn from the smoothing capacitor. Not quite, because as you see in the illustration, there's still some degree of ripple. But as you increase the capacitance of the smoothing capacitor, the ripple will get smaller and smaller and will start to approach something like B. But that's a different thing entirely. This is the current at the actual rectifier. what you have to think in terms is, what is the smoothing capacitor doing there? The smoothing capacitor is making up for periods where there's no voltage potential being fed because it's only a half-wave rectifier. So what's happening is the voltage getting to the capacitor, it looks a lot like C, where it's a bump and then nothing and a bump and nothing, because that's what a half-wave rectifier is as opposed to a full-wave rectifier. A full-wave rectifier would give you a voltage potential of something that looks like curve A. So you have curve C, that's the voltage potential. So when it goes into the capacitor, at first it charges it, which creates a current, and then when it's charged, it stops producing a current by itself and just sits there until it either self-discharges or gets another charge to its plates.
So, yeah, I was going to say, hey, of course, it's kind of obvious now, but you said it already. Anyway, shows how much I know about all this. Yeah, it makes a lot more sense, doesn't it? So, back to you, Roy.
Okay, so the answer is, unfortunately, there is a big difference between what the voltage is and what the current is. If it was the voltage to the resistor, it would be C. But because it's the current to the resistor, it's curve D, which is a very, very choppy thing, because you also have to realize that during those blank periods, the capacitor itself is discharging into the load. And that's what smooths out the current and from a power supply. It's always good to usually use a full bridge rectifier, because then you have more of the voltage to deal with, and it's a little bit easier to smooth out the current. You don't need as much of a capacitor. But the answer for that one is D. So okay, we did the TechNet puzzle. I will ask once again, if anyone out there has any technical questions or any problems with the puzzle that they'd like to discuss, please give me your first name and your call sign.
VP, I guess I got it as wrong as I could get it. Pretty wrong. All right, right, great. Back to you. Hope someone has some other input.
Okay, you know, I mean, it's no problem. That's how we learn, you know. If I gave you simple things, it would kind of bore you and me and everyone else. So, you know, hopefully this will kind of give you a better sense of what's going on in a power supply. And that's sort of the purpose. I mean, I try not to come up with really ridiculous, tricky questions. But it's hopefully a little bit of a learning experience for us all. You have any other questions or topics you want to discuss, Bob? Because it seems like it's you, me, Mo, and Jason. So please, if you have any other questions.
I'm trying to think here. I should have sat down and thought about this for an hour or something before I came on. Drop it for a minute.
Well, Roy, I have a comment to one of the question answers from a little bit earlier tonight.
Again, if we're still here when I think of something.
Okay, Joe and Bob doubled. Joe, you wanted to ask a question on an answer I gave.
Well, it's more of a comment to that answer. I could tell you definitely the answer not to give when they ask you, does this dress make look fat? The answer definitely is not no. Your fat makes you look fat.
Well, Joe, I assume you have a charmed life. I always caution people not to start up with their spouses because they're lying right next to them, and that pillow is just waiting to cover your face in the middle of the night. But I'm sure that's not going to happen to you. Well, at least no one has suggested that any woman's dress is promising. But the fact of the matter, if you notice, almost no one doesn't say this result is promising. It's really faint praise indeed.
Yeah, yep. to try to add a little bit of, make it a little bit more lighter out here tonight. But all right, man. I'll give it back on over to you. I'm interested in hearing Bob's question again. AC2.
Okay, very good, Joe. Bob, you have a question?
Yeah, I didn't. I was saying I'm trying to think of one, and I haven't. I'm just kind of drawing a blank. I guess I'm on the spot now, which kind of makes the mind go blank sometimes. So much I don't know. I get to know enough to ask a question. Let me drop and think about it, and I'll hope somebody else will come in with something. To RGA with a question.
Yes, please. What's your question?
What is the meaning of life? No, I'm kidding. I have like a 120-foot run of coax, and what is the good coax, but not like 400, 400 ultraflex or anything like that, but a good price coax that's not too expensive and not cheap. What kind of coax should I replace my five lengths of 120 feet coax with? I use the thin stuff.
Okay, what size are you interested in? I assume you don't want to use something that's RG8 thickness. So that's about 4/10 of an inch in diameter.
Well, 3/8. That's what I got, the thick stuff. And one run that's for my Intron 99 is the thin, good stuff, the Ultraflex, the skinny stuff version of it.
Okay, well, the problem with thin coaxial cable is even the high-quality stuff has a greater attenuation rate and a lower power rate, especially at higher frequencies. Now, if you're not going to go to UHF, VHF, you can use thinner coax, but if you want to run, 1.5 kilowatts, you might want not to run too thin. RG213, a lot of people swear by it. I have not really used it, but the specs are relatively very good. There are store brands. DX Engineering has store brands for those type that have good attenuation loss. What you really want to do is look at all these coaxial cables come with tables that talk about their attenuation loss, and you'll be able to, given the frequency that you're going to use them for, it'll tell you how much it attenuates, and you want that to be as small as possible. People have been known to do things like run RG58, runs of it for 150 feet to feed a 440 line. And when they look it up in the table, they find that about 2/3 of their power ends up heating up their coaxial cables. So 213 is a good type of coax cable, in my estimation. But there's a lot of them. DX Engineering sells some relatively good quality stuff. Some of it is at a little bit of a premium. You might get a better deal with a different a vendor for something more generic like 213. But you should always kind of double check on the specifications sheet to see what the attenuation loss and what the power handling capacity for these things are, depending upon what you plan to use it for.
Okay. Yeah, that's basically what was my question. It's only like 120 feet. I think that's the longest run. The stuff going up to the chimney, I'm not going to do. But I got, two. I want to make a third run for an 80-meter antenna. Eventually, I want to get a dipole up on the roof, but I got to get someone to go up there to do it. But okay, good. That answers my question. So 213, good quality is good enough, the 213. Well, you used to 9913 was always the go-to back in the CB days and before I became a ham and at the beginning when I was a ham. The problem with that is moisture gets into the there's a plastic band that wraps around the coax. It leaves it what's the word for it, like in the air where it's not touching the sides, and moisture always got in there and ruined the coax. You had to replace it after a year.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's good things and there's bad things about 213. 213 does not have a solid dielectric. The LMR 400 has a solid propylene dielectric. The I believe the 213 has a kind of, as you mentioned, a kind of corkscrew plastic inset that most of the dielectric is air, which actually gives it better specs. It has some better specs simply because it's not a solid dielectric. The downside is you have to be very cautious and weatherproof the edges. I mean, as general rule, I do that even with my LMR 400. And there have been articles and magazine articles and newsletter articles about how to do that. People will kind of put a dielectric, basically glorified Vaseline, into the connector, screw it in so that the water can get into the connector. Then they'll wrap it with the silicone fusing tape over that to make a seal, and then they'll take some good old electrical tape and cover that thing up. And you know, the better you wrap it up for almost all coax cables, but that is a negative as far as the 213. It is an open core dielectric.
All right, great. Thank you. I appreciate that. That gives me a lot to think about. All right, and to RGA, back to that.
Okay, very good. And there, you know, there of course are other sources for all these cables at similar configurations. The LMR 400 is nice in that it's doubly shielded. It has a copper webbing, and then it has an aluminum cover over that. So there's a lot more isolation than something like a 213, which just has a nice dense copper shielding to it. But, you know, there are other manufacturers. I would urge against no-name or no-brand cables. There have been a lot of cables out there that their manufacturers don't even list their manufacturing name on the jacket, and that's a definite no-no. So if you know someone who kind of got a great deal on something that he bought, say, 4 or 5 years ago and it's still holding up, that might be another option.
There's a Chinese coax. Actually, they're all made in China now. There's a Chinese coax. I can't think of the name. It starts with an S. And a friend of mine, Tommy, swore by it. He tested it out with the other coax, and he loved it. That's Saxony. I can't think of the name, but it starts with an S. And it was compatible to LMR 400. It was actually named LMR 400, but with different letters in front of it.
Yeah, they've done that a lot because that's kind of the premium product in the field. So if you can, and it's not too difficult to kind of reproduce the general characteristics. It may be a little bit more difficult to get the quality, but some Chinese manufacturers make very high-quality stuff. The problem is figuring out the difference between the legitimate ones and the not-quite-legitimate ones. So, again, if you can find someone who's had a well-known, if there is such a thing, Chinese manufacturer, and you have a good idea that you have access to a retailer that will actually sell you that, because unfortunately, the Chinese companies kind of rob from each other. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if there was some shady little company in China that was counterfeiting even a Chinese brand of coaxial cable. But, usually people kind of will give you almost immediately their experiences. And if you find people who say, yeah, I bought this Chinese brand at such and such, and it's been holding up for 4, 5, 6, 7 years, then, you might be able to save a couple of shekels.
All right, thanks, Roy. I appreciate it. And to RGA, I'll be on the side.
Okay, Doc, thanks for participating. Mitch, once again, this is AC2GS, Roy, net control operator for the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net that meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. So if you have any questions of a technical nature, or if you would like to suggest a particular brand of coaxial cable, please give me your first name and your call sign.
WF2N, Jason.
Yes, Jason.
Thanks, Roy. Just wanted to make a comment on coax. I second the RG213, although not for outdoor use, and not because I don't recommend, because it's bad outdoors, but I just haven't used it outdoors before. I do run RG213 between my amplifier and tuner, and between my rig and amplifier. And I also use them for common mode chokes, and they work great, especially if you plan to use high power. So I run a kilowatt of power through these cables, and they work just great. So definitely recommend them for indoor stuff, but again, can't say much about the outdoors yet. And as for a supplier, there's a USACoax.com if you need like pre-selected lengths of coax and pre-made. They usually have pretty good deals, and I think they're also on Amazon. So check them out. I've had pretty good experiences with them. Back to net.
Okay, thank you very much, Jason. I think Mitch likes to cut and put connectors on his own. I've seen those guys, and it makes life much easier if you just want certain lengths of the jumper cable, and you don't have to footer around with a crimping tool or something. But that's another option as well. But I can't recall the name of the particular Chinese. The problem that I have with Chinese manufacturers is they usually Americanize brand names, because if you check what their real name is, it's usually something quite unpronounceable to people who didn't practice Mandarin Chinese. Anyway, once again, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. Roy here, net control operator for the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net that meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. If you have a technical question or a topic, or would you want to make a comment about something that we've been discussing before, then please give us your call sign and your first name.
AC2GS. Copy, November 4, Echo Sierra Uniform, Glenn in Bay Ridge.
Yes, hello, Glenn. How are you tonight? Do you have a question tonight?
I know you're talking about coax. I got mine from DX Engineering, and I'm pretty happy with the quality of their stuff. I don't know if you're familiar with it or have purchased theirs.
I'm familiar with it. I kind of have an all LMR 400. I use the LMR 400 Flex for my jumpers. But they look to be high quality, and almost everything that I've gotten from DX Engineering, it tends to be good, high-quality stuff. I don't know if they give you that much of a bargain. You probably know better than I. Do you know what the kind of running cost for something similar to either a 213 or a... One sec. Either a 213 or an LMR 400 might go per foot?
I don't. It's been a while since I bought mine, so I really don't remember what it ran me.
Yeah, I would assume that they're not quite the dollar a foot that LMR 400 is, but they're probably relatively close. Again, they sell high quality stuff. They have a good brand presence, and so I don't think you'd be able to save a lot of money by DX Engineering, but I do find them a very, very responsible company, and I buy a lot of things through DX Engineering, and I've never been disappointed. I've been nickeled and dimed by some other companies where you're supposed to get your stuff shipped for free, but if they don't stock it all in one time and they have to spread it out to two orders, they end up charging you shipping for the second one. And, you know, that's awful. I've never had anything like that happen with DX Engineering.
I actually got to visit their little shop in Ohio when we were passing through one day. And it's pretty interesting. It's a tiny little section of the store, you know, in their automotive I forget the name of the brand of their automotive company, but there's a little corner in their showroom for ham radio stuff, and then the guy was telling me about how they do most of their shipping out of the warehouse down the road. So very interesting, nice people.
Yeah, I have nothing but respect for them. It's almost every single time that I ordered anything that they had in stock, and they do indicate when they don't have it in stock, but anytime I order something in stock, that night it gets shipped. I don't think I know of any other place, with the exception occasionally of Amazon when it's in a good mood, to handle that. But I do recall reading about their history. They started out as guys that made race cars or sports car accessories, and they were making these aluminum brackets and holders and thingamabobs, and someone decided that they could use something like that to mount antennas, and they just expanded and expanded and expanded. And it's a great resource for amateur radio. I would suggest that everyone get on their catalog list. Reading their catalog and reading HRO's catalog can give you an education by itself.
Just Summit Racing is the name of the automobile branch, and they have a pretty impressive ham radio station at the showroom. I guess it's their main hub in Ohio. I forget what town it is in Ohio, but it was pretty impressive when you drove up and you saw their antenna array on the roof of their building. Back to you.
Yeah, there's a guy who's the chief spokesman or something, the K3LR. He has this massive contest shack at an adjoining state. I think he lives on the other side of the border, and he travels in. And it just was amazing to see what his contest shack looks like. It's one of those massive multi-operator systems with wall-to-wall radio sets. And you know, you could have a row of operators simultaneously, running during contest times. It's sort of amazing. I'm sure there's YouTubes of them doing that.
I recommend, if you're ever in that area of Ohio, you should definitely, if you pass by, stop in and check it out. It's a pretty cool place. I didn't get to see their shack, but they did have a pretty impressive antenna array. And I think they actually let you go and operate there if you want. But thanks. Thank you. Back to you.
Okay, very good, Glenn. Once again, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am net control operator for the Kings County Radio Club's technical net that's on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month. And if you have any technical questions or technical topics or want to make a comment about anything that we've been discussing for the last 50 minutes or so, please hit that push-to-talk button, give us your call sign and your first name.
NDB. I actually had a couple questions, and I just thought of something from the last exchange of ideas. Anyway, back to you.
Yeah, sure, Bob. What's your question?
First one I thought about, I was reading a QST article in the new magazine, and it just mentioned something I didn't know before, but it makes sense, talking about, like, if you're offering a QRP radio, let's just say, like, a 10-watt radio, and the difference between that and offering, like, say, your 100-watt radio and turning it down to 10 watts, they were saying, like, of course, the more powerful radio turned down is less efficient as far as battery use. There was an article on battery use in the new QST. I was wondering if there's any, like, you know, ratio that's consistent with that, or probably not. So you'd know how much less efficient, like, say, running my 7100 at 10 watts as opposed to having, like, a QRP rig. Back to you. That was the first question.
Okay, yeah, I read that as well. And that's sort of a given for everything. You can build relatively efficient devices to a degree, but you're not going to be able to optimize the power use in wide ranges of power. Some radios are simply designed a lot more efficient in general. Different radios will have different power requirements for something as simple as just receiving and never transmitting at all. So you can have easily 5 or 6 times more power output due to the fact that they're running a microprocessor, they're running a full color display, and there's a whole bunch of other things that are operating along with the simple radio receiving and audio amplification circuits. In addition, as far as transmitters are concerned, you can build a much more efficient transmitter if you set the power level low completely than if you allow it to be varied and raise and lower the gain, because you're building the ancillary circuits to tolerate the high-end power, and that usually leads to more insertion loss. And they're different for every radio. It's not inherent in the power rating. It's a complex combination of the power rating and the general design and the amount of time and effort that the electrical engineer puts on the final design for the radio. But it's always a good idea to kind of take a look at the specs and see what the standby mode power output requirement is and what the receive-only power requirement is. I don't know if anyone really, unfortunately, gives too many specs with the power set to low, medium, and high. Some do, I guess, but some don't. But, you know, the more you know about those models, the better it is. But there's no easy, simple equation to plug in to get an answer, unfortunately.
That's what I figured. Yeah. Yeah, I was just thinking of that when you were talking about display and stuff. I think this has been discussed before, that new Icon 705 is supposed to have that, you know, nice display like a 7300 and all that, which, of course, is going to draw more battery power. I wonder if I'll have to look at it. Probably could get the answer that way. Whether they built in a way you could shut that down or make it, yeah, you probably turn it down dim-wise. There are probably ways you can reduce the power, but it's probably still going to be less efficient than maybe some of the other QRP rigs. Is that true, Roy, do you think?
Yeah, unfortunately it is, because there's a lot more overhead. It's a sophisticated piece of equipment that's designed to be more than just a simple QRP low-power radio. It's sort of built a lot like the Elecraft KX2S and KX3S, in that it's a software-defined radio. It has a full-color touch display. There's a lot of electronics going on. I'm sure that you'll be able to dim it. How far you can dim it, I don't know. They're not going to let you probably turn off the display, because since some of the controls are touch controls, you would lose some of the usability. But they'll probably have a nice battery that fits into it, and there'll probably be some kind of a device that you can plug into an external power supply. You're not going to get a lot of information yet, as far as I'm aware, At best, they will probably start to sell them in July. Right now, I've looked in Japan's own website for documentation, and all I find is an early bird brochure on the subject that doesn't get into the nitty-gritty details. I'm really looking forward to read up on what the 705 can really do. And the price that it might be. I think we talked about that to a degree during our 10-meter net recently, and I think they quoted something like 1,300 pounds in England, and the big question is, will they upscale that so that it's the equivalent dollars to pounds, or as very often manufacturers weirdly do, they keep it in the same number. So it might very well be $1,300 in the United States and 1,300 pounds in the United Kingdom.
I heard that on the 10-meter net. I was listening to you guys on the easiest way for me is on the computer stream. Anyway, yeah, I was hoping it'd be more like $1,000, like maybe even as cheap as the 7,300 has become, which is maybe like $900, but I guess not. So it's probably not going to be that cheap. I was wondering if going back to that display thing, if the FT3D, you know, Yaesu anti-talky is significantly drains more battery than the FT2D because it has that color display. I wonder how significant that is. It also has like Bluetooth and other stuff, which may also probably contribute to that. Back to you.
I unfortunately have heard both lines. I've heard people complain that their 3 it just kind of drains their battery. I've had other people tell me that they haven't seen any difference, really. I would assume that there is more power being applied to the 3 to the full color display of the 3 than to the monochrome of the 2. And I don't know. I don't think I've read any real good scientific experiments to simply test how long it took to discharge a battery. But again, I wouldn't be at all surprised if it's a little bit less efficient than monochrome screens.
Gotcha. So maybe it's not all that significant, but yeah, it's too bad they can't just switch between the two, but of course you'd probably have to have two different sets of electronics for the two different technologies, so it would make things even worse. Back to you. I have another question if you want. It's a totally different question.
Yeah, unfortunately, the only legitimate way to do something like that is to have two separate displays. Then you have a problem because they're touch displays. So how do you parallel two touch displays at the same time? So I don't think any electrical engineer would want to even attempt something like that. So they just deal with the most efficient design, full-color display that they can get and suffer the losses. But you can ask the other question if you want, Bob.
Well, you're talking about, when you're talking to Mitch about cables and stuff, you're talking about crimping and, yeah, to bring up that old debate. I was listening to some of the old K2RIW tech nets from like 2006, and Dick, at least at that time, had a strong opinion. He didn't think crimping was as good as soldering, and I was just to bring up, maybe this is almost like a political issue in ham radio, I don't know, but or a religion issue, but yeah, I just wondering what your opinion is on that. Maybe it depends on what you're doing it for. So I'll just throw that to you. Back to you. This is KDG2NVB, back to Ned.
Yeah, Bob, you're quite right. It's basically a religious thing almost. There's a whole bunch of topics that you can bring up on HF, and then quickly run away because people yell and scream at each other for the next 5-6 hours. Especially guys who've been in the hobby a long time have been burnt by crimps in the past. So the same way that very often you'll get sort of the same type of reaction when you talk about switching power supplies, and they'll tell you how they had a switching power supply that was living hell. And they would only use linear power supplies. The bottom line is, if you ask a commercial rigger, a guy who does it for a living with commercial companies that rely on connections for their profit margin, they all crimp. So if you know how to crimp, and if you use the proper tools to crimp, and you use the proper connectors to crimp, crimping should at the very least give you just as good a job as soldering. If you don't, then soldering, and you're just more adept at using soldering irons to do it, then it works the other way. And so that's why whatever anyone is kind of used to, they continue to use, and they swear by it, and they curse the other end of the spectrum. So I have, for the most part, used crimping tools. I feel comfortable with the crimping tools. I have seen awful crimps in the past from people, and you just have to kind of follow the correct instructions and do it the right way and pull on it and make sure that it's a good connection. But, you know, and there are things that I crimp that most other people do as well. The power poles that have become ubiquitous. Some people will, after they crimp them, they'll solder them. I have read reports where some people suggest you absolutely shouldn't do that because that adds another problem to how power poles can get screwed up. But I would say that if you're comfortable and you're using the proper equipment, that crimping is fine. And I'm sure there'll be other opinions out there. So if anyone else has any opinions on the subject, please feel free to give us your opinions.
Comment?
Yes, please comment.
All righty. I happen to be soldering. Well, I happen to be crimping and soldering right now as we speak, while I'm listening to you guys. And I've always been a fan of both. You know, I've heard the debate on crimp and solder and crimp and solder. So I said, why not, along with a mechanical connection, make an electrical connection? Solder it too. I haven't had a problem with it, and I've been doing it for about maybe 7 or 8 years, maybe even longer now. So I definitely say crimp and solder.
Okay, Joe, you're basically saying that you're a belt and suspenders guy.
Well, else am I going to hold my HT?
Yes, indeed. Well, you know, a lot of so-called crimping connectors require a degree of solder anyway. Usually, there are some cases where the center connector is crimped on, but a lot of them leave the center connector just dangling out the front, and they want you to solder that portion. So there are also connectors that are crimp and solder. Again, if you use the proper technique, I don't think that one is any worse than the other.
Yeah, I don't think so either, but I don't know. I've always liked to have that electrical connection. I don't know. I slide out from each other not done correctly. It's just a whole bunch of things. You know, it goes both ends. But you can say about solder, you know. You can pull solder joints when it doesn't have correctly, you know. It goes both directions. Yeah. Religion and politics.
Yes, indeed, religion and politics. Yeah, you could do anything wrong. Just because people have soldered, I've mentioned already that I've seen terrible crimps where you just put, you know, an eighth of an ounce of force on one end and the whole thing comes apart. I've also seen god-awful examples of soldering. So, you know, people can screw up any technology. So, again, the bottom line is if you feel comfortable with one or the other, you've done it, it's gone well for you, then congratulations, keep on doing it. But as far as I'm aware, just about every commercial guy, you know, cable rigger, has a crimping tool. He doesn't futz around with soldering irons anymore. So, you know, if you think that they're wrong, that's your right to think that way. Again, it's more efficient. If you feel comfortable with it and you have the right tools and equipment and time is money, I guess the efficiency of crimping outdoes the extra, security of adding solder to the mix. AC2GS. Any more questions or topics tonight?
VB with another sort of question, comment, but in regard to the DX engineering and the guy having the contesting shack.
Yes, Bob.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember, but I think it might be that the owner of DX Engineering, who has this incredible antenna farm, and, you know, there was a whole YouTube I looked at. I might have even heard about this on the Limark TechNet, or even your TechNet, I mean, a year or so ago. And you go to their site, and you can do this thing where it just gives you this, like, 360 kind of video showing all the Yagis and all these things on several towers around this guy's place. I think this was the guy who was the owner of DX Engineering. Does that sound right to you, Roy? Back to you.
His call sign is K3LR. His real legit name is Timothy Duffy. I don't think he's the president. I think he was the head of marketing. I can't really tell you for sure if he had any actual day-to-day business responsibilities, or if he was kind of the front for DX Engineering, because he is such an incredibly a famous contester. I mean, he doesn't really explain. He certainly doesn't say he's the president. The way he describes it on his QRZ page is he works at DX Engineering. So I think he's either head of marketing, or he's just the guy that you associate with it. And like I said, he has an enormous contest facility. I'm sure he actually has a website that's www.k3lr.com that has much more information about him than the QRZ page.
Yeah, I think that's where I went. It's been over a year, might even be a couple of years. Yeah, I'll go back. I'll check it out. Yeah, he's probably not the janitor there, but he works at DX Engineering. Cool. Yeah, thanks, Roy. So I guess I'm through for now. Back to net.
Okay, very good, Bob. Thanks for participating. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm net control operator for the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net, heard on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. on this repeater. If anyone else has any questions or topics they would like to discuss of a technical nature, please feel free. Otherwise, I guess we'll call it a night with this episode. But if you have any questions, please tell me. This is AC2GS. Okay, Doc. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesdays of each month. Our next meeting will be June 3rd, which will be held by teleconferencing. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Our regular general meetings start at 8 p.m. and continue until anywhere from 9 to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. We have a weekly net featuring Yaesu's Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club repeater. If you can communicate using Fusion technology, please join in. You can connect to our repeater while in Fusion Digital mode, either directly using Fusion Digital Technology radios or by using a hotspot in some other digital mode using our network gateways, such as our XLX servers. We offer an audio stream of the Fusion Net on the Internet, as well as all audio transmissions on our club repeater at stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is available on our website. If you would like to contact the hosts of this TechNet, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. Now, once again, gentlemen, in this time of coronavirus and pandemic, I want to wish you all a safe time. Continue to realize what's going on. No reason to panic, but no reason to grow apathetic and fatigue of it all and say, we tried as hard as we can. Let's live life like we used to. It's going to be a little weird for the time being until there's a vaccination, until there's something demonstrative that is going to knock this virus out of its present state with us. So please take it seriously and take your own health seriously and the health of others around you. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. So we're going to roll this all up and shut it down now, but we'll be back to do it all over again June 10th, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, especially my co-host, Jason WF2N. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So this is Roy, AC2GS, and I'll be going clear and getting the heck out of here. Stay safe, everyone. Until next time. Bye.
Stay safe, Roy, WF2N.
Roy and Jay in Georgia.
For the net, Roy.
KD2MDB going clear, 73.